So we'll take questions. I have a few in front of me, but also if anyone wants to go to the microphone, go ahead. So I'll give you a minute to go to the microphone. And I'm looking at a few of these. Alessandro Del Ponte chimed in right away, Jack Painter. And a kind of a theme in a number of these is, what can we do about this, right? And as Jack put it, what can we do to counter the growing control from the information revolution? I mean, you just look at this chart, look at this data, look at who they're citing. And as I started off by saying, we all know about Marxism applied to culture. It goes back to Gramsci, it goes back to the Frankfurt School. And now if you type in cultural Marxism into Google, it says you're peddling anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. And by the way, I wrote two pieces on that for American Spectator, and I wrote the second one noting what happened to me, how that misinformation, disinformation was used against me. And a student came to me a few weeks after that piece and said, guess what, it's been changed. Google took it down, good news. Well, then the Southern Poverty Law Center started saying it, and they've now listed it as an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, so now it's right back up at Google. So you're fighting this monster, this beast called you know, the information highway, the internet, and what can we even do against something like that? When people pull out their phone and say, hey, Alexa or Siri or whatever, what is cultural Marxism? Cultural Marxism is an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, right? What do you do? What do you do? It's 200 people in this room against the world. Any thoughts? Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Probably the first thing that we should be doing is to get back and try to understand actually what is going on. I'm very glad that Phil has mentioned Hayek and intellectuals and socialism as a sort of starting point for our ways of understanding what is called the theory of the climate of opinion and the way we should be approaching the strategies and tactics of this type of approach. And it comes a moment at which we should ask ourselves, if that theory, if that strategy and that tactics articulated in that model is so good, why are we failing? What's wrong? Are we unable to implement, to operationalize that approach? Or maybe that approach is not capturing correctly what is going on, right? Because everything that has been said at this table shows, first of all, that the alternative approaches are deeply flawed, but on the other hand, the approach that we are advancing, it's losing ground again and again at the institutional level. So therefore, maybe we should be starting thinking in different ways about the strategy and the tactics, as opposed to thinking ideologically, we should be starting thinking institutionally. Mm-hmm. We are confronted with an organizational and technological revolution. And therefore, we should be thinking about ideas, ideologies, doctrines in that context. Obviously, the climate of opinion, the structure of production of ideas, the marketplace of ideas as a model has failed us. At one point, we should be recognizing that. It is a good starting point, but it should be placed in the larger picture, and we have to reconstruct that picture. So organizational revolution, we are confronted with it, we have to deal with it, or otherwise we are going to lose indefinitely this type of confrontation that we are dealing with. Second, we are on the defensive. Definitely won't be able on the short run to control the field. Therefore, we have to consolidate the resistance points. Again, I have a mic problem. So we have to consolidate the resistance points, right? And wait for better things to happen until we'll be able to mount an offensive. At this point, we are not in a position to mount an offensive, and it would be silly to pretend that we are able to do that. But this is the way we are behaving, right? We are losing again and again. We are unable to consolidate on institutional positions and organizational positions. And yet we are pretending that the counteroffensive is here, is near. We are able to do that. Do we have the resources? We don't have even the strategies and the tactics for that.
And one final point, yes.
If you'll turn that one off.
This one off, okay.
Okay, and one final point regarding this misunderstanding about the strategy and the tactics. We are thinking on the short run. This is not something that will be settled by the generation which is at this table, in this room. As long as we are thinking of organizing our structures, our strategies, our tactics on the short run perspective, maybe bringing a sort of business plan or market type of approach to our strategies, we are going to fail, because this is not something which is going to be measured on the short run. So I think that this is, in a nutshell, my way of responding to the idea what is to be done. And what is to be done is something that I have already mentioned from the very beginning. We have to understand the nature of the challenge. The nature of the challenge is not distortions in the institutions. Let's fix the distortions and let's get back to normal. This is not going to happen. So there will be no returning back to the previous institutional structure and the previous equilibrium. We might be able to recreate a new equilibrium which is satisfying institutional criteria of freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of trade, or we might not be able to recreate that equilibrium, but we are not going to fix institutional distortions and get back to normal.
Thoughts over here. By the way, Ronald Reagan, Whitaker Chambers, John Paul II all said the battle is not political and intellectual, but spiritual. Figured I'd throw that in.
I would suggest that institutional change begins with not supporting or sending children to institutions that are full of this kind of thinking that Amen. We've been decrying. And there are many other institutions which have a solid basis in the classical tradition and in the respect to technology. Our college forbids cell phones and limits internet use in order that students will be one with their material, which is beautiful, instead of distractions which keep them from a fully reflective life. I think these kinds of adjustments are not necessarily changing structures, but I'll fight Eros with Eros, making students love what's truly lovable and beautiful.
Nice.
So I'd simply add on the question of going on the offensive, why hasn't Marxism been canceled? Why hasn't Karl Marx himself been personally canceled? By every criteria that they used to tear down George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, every other major figure of the American tradition, Karl Marx is immensely worse. He has a body count behind him. He liked to use the N-word. He despised immigrants. He despised Jewish people. He forwarded racist and anti-Semitic conspiracy theories throughout his work, and generally was a terrible person in his human life. And yet, what we find is the same standards are not applied to their own.
Yeah, well put. Question.
Thank you. David Forte here. Phil, I just have a small, it's probably just a footnote historical question regarding the popularity of Marxism before the revolution. Jean V. Debs gained 1 million votes running as president, and to my mind, he was a Marxist. Maybe I'm wrong on that. So could you clarify, was that anomalous, a Marxist that actually was popular before the Russian Revolution?
And so the question was on Eugene V. Debs. He was a socialist. He was not explicitly a Marxist. In fact, he was a pacifist. It was one of his major drivers. That's what got him basically put in prison in the aftermath of World War I. So there were other socialist traditions, and we find in the history of Marx's own life, he was constantly involved in schismatic internecine disputes with other socialists. Basically collapsed the International Working Men's Association because the other factions recognized that he was putting them on the route to violent upheaval, potentially genocide. And in the aftermath of that, Marx is shunned and pushed aside. This is basically his legacy from around the time of his death in 1883 to the eve of the Russian Revolution. He is one of many, many small contestants for the claimant of the socialist mantle. Some data points on that I've actually dug into quite a bit is you can find that other socialist traditions were emerging and cited at higher rates than Karl Marx in the years before the Russian Revolution, the most notable being the left-wing branch of Henry George's movement, Georgism.
Yes, sir.
Zeebarth, there, one thing that you all seem to miss is the essential truth that Mao Tse-tung articulated. Power comes from the mouth of a gun. The reason that the intellectual community, broadly speaking, has adopted what they call Marxism today is very simple. They provide a tool for people who are, in fact, unsound to control the political narrative and to seize power for themselves. I remember sitting in Rome one night with somebody at the Max, he was the director of the Max Planck Institute, and I finally asked him, why were all of you during the 1920s and the 1930s, well, why did you all suddenly decide that Nazism was wonderful? And he said, well, of course we always go with the winning side. And that is a lesson not to be forgotten. The basis of academic Marxism today is nothing more than the desire of very clever but unsound people to seize political power and to control the lives of others.
Well, and they have power behind them again through technology and social media, cancel culture. But you know, also they only have as much power as you'll allow them in some cases. I mean, what does it truly mean to be canceled, right? I mean, a lot of academics are cowards. As soon as they get criticized one time on Facebook, they curl up in the fetal position and you don't hear from them again. I mean, so what if these people call you names? Fight back. Yes.
Yes, Dr. Magnus, I have a question for you. I'm totally with your analysis on the development of socialism, alternative socialist thinkers vis-a-vis the development of socialist theory. But what's interesting, of course, modern socialists say, well, don't look at the communist systems. Those weren't true, you know, socialist systems. But if you go to the website of, I think, the Socialist Party of the USA, and I think devised by Harrington, and you want to learn about socialism, the first thing they ask you to read is Karl Marx. Right. So how do you explain that disconnect? I mean, if they want to disassociate themselves from the Soviet model, why are they preaching Marx when there are, you know, a plethora of other socialist thinkers that might be, you know, wiser for them to promote than Marx? Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
You know, I think that's an important question for us to all consider, because it taps into the broader question, why has Marx himself not been discredited by a very visible legacy? Well, part of it, I think, comes down to a basic dishonesty. Socialists today are always enamored with the latest socialist movement. We saw this most recently when Hugo Chavez seized control in Venezuela. The American left rallied behind him and said, this is the way that we will defeat globalization and neoliberalism and all the boogeymen that they're constantly attacking. Hugo Chavez has proved that socialism can work. 5 years later, they wanted nothing to do with him. But this is a recurring pattern across the 20th century. They flocked to Lenin's Russia in the aftermath of the Bolshevik Revolution. American left-wing intellectuals that were attracted to some of these ideas went to Lenin's Russia, came back, and proclaimed that they had seen the future and it worked. It was Lincoln Steffens' observation. We even had a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist of the New York Times engaged in a cover-up of Stalin's famines in explicit ways. And it was actually other figures, both on the right and left, that had greater honesty in their work that noticed this and called him out on it. It was the Walter Duranty case. But this is a pattern we see across socialist history, is those that embrace the Marxist doctrine put the objective at the end ahead of intellectual honesty, of evidence, of fact, of truth, of even their own narratives. And this is, again, I'll harken back to Hayek. He observed in The Road to Serfdom, why did the worst get on top? And his answer to that is that they're willing to engage in unscrupulous tactics and means to put themselves there.
Well, it's 10 o'clock. We need to wrap up. So we have a coffee break, 10 to 10:30. And if I'll just say one thing in closing. I think Virginia's advice about where you send your kids to college is very significant, right? And there are good options out there, all right? University of St. Thomas, Wyoming Catholic, George Mason, Grove City College, Hillsdale. And if you must send them somewhere else, which in the case of my oldest daughter, is the case, there are also ways to keep them on track with certain organizations at those schools, whether YAF or ISI or Campus Crusade or the Newman Center, right? So there are ways to navigate through that and get through it, but you gotta be vigilant, you gotta be attentive to it. Carissa asked me to announce that there are assisted listening devices available at the AV table in the back of the meeting room, available on a first-come basis if you need them. But thank you all very much, and the next panel will be on the entrepreneur. That's at 10:30. Until then, we have a coffee break. Thanks.